In the United States, getting an insurer to pay for your annual checkup is a lot easier than finding coverage for mental health or substance abuse. You told us about it.
When I was relying on private health insurance, I did not have sufficient coverage for mental health care.
The provider network is very limited. I have 5 free sessions with a therapist, and then after that, I have to pay the rest out of pocket.
Medicare will reimburse me for my psychiatrist.
I was getting charged well over $500 per session. This was unsustainable, and I had to stop.
I had to ration my treatment because I paid out of pocket.
The problem I have is saving enough money for my visit.
And they give me a problem about getting reimbursement.
I'm a mental health counselor, so the work I want to do with my clients is monitored, regulated, and even prevented by a lack of coverage from the insurance companies.
But what am I to do? It's a lifeline.
Now that I'm on medical assistance, I do have sufficient coverage.
I get what I need, but sometimes I have to wait to save up, even though they have a sliding scale.
I think the financial stress is a bona fide contraindication for the therapy. Oh well.
This problem of haphazard insurance coverage is rampant. Mental illness impacts nearly 50 million Americans a year, and substance addiction impacts at least 20 million. Congress tried to address the disparity between medical coverage back in 2008 when it passed the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. That legislation was supposed to guarantee comparable insurance coverage of mental health and substance abuse disorders. But a new report out this week from Bloomberg says some insurers have worked to evade the law, and that patients often find their mental health coverage inadequate. Meanwhile, more Americans are dying from mental health illnesses and addiction. From 2008, when the parity law was passed, to 2016, the suicide rate increased by 16% and fatal overdoses climbed by 66%. Today, we're going to talk about it. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Here to discuss that report is Cynthia Kunz, a healthcare reporter for Bloomberg. Cynthia, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Dr. Patrice Harris, the president-elect of the American Medical Association. Dr. Harris, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me as well.
So, Cynthia, let's start with you. Why did Congress feel they needed to pass a law to improve mental health and addiction coverage to begin with?
This was a mission driven by Patrick Kennedy. And you may recall he crashed his car on Capitol Hill and came public with the addiction and mental health conditions that he had been suffering in his life. And so he drove an effort to create a law that would make mental health equivalent to medical health in terms of what insurers are required to cover. The problem was it wasn't a case of there being a ton of political momentum for this. They actually tacked this on to the TARP bill, which you may recall bailed out America's banks. And sometimes that happens with laws. They get tacked into other things. So this wasn't necessarily the response of this huge outcry, this march on the mall, this idea that millions of Americans were crying out, we need this. Unfortunately, a lot of mental health and substance abuse conditions go people don't talk about them. There's a stigma around this type of medical care that has pervaded and prevented people from seeking care or speaking out.
Dr. Harris, do insurance companies and lawmakers view mental health concerns as serious physical ailments, as serious ailments to begin with?
Well, I have to say the stigma that has long been associated with those who have mental illnesses or substance use disorders still remains. The good news is more people are talking about their mental illnesses, more people are talking about their substance use disorder diagnoses. So we're getting better, but we still have a long way to go to eliminate that stigma and make sure that these mental illnesses and substance use disorders, those who have them, get access to the treatment they need. You mentioned the numbers. They are staggering. I am a psychiatrist, so I have been intimately involved with filling out paperwork and defending that my patients need more visits because at times there were visits or limits on the number of visits. So we're getting there, but we still have a long way to go. And I think the key issue is there needs to be much stronger enforcement and oversight of that parity law and other laws that are meant to protect patients with a mental health or substance use disorder.
Cynthia, I want to ask you, since this Parity Act has passed, has access to care increased, or is it that more people are seeking care?
So there are some promising numbers. There was a federal study that came out in February that showed that those who are seeking treatment are getting more frequent visits than they might have been previously. More people are accessing substance abuse treatment in an outpatient setting. But there were other things that showed up in the substance abuse arena. People were spending more out of pocket for care. So there are things that are going on that are they're promising signs. But one of the problems is, in particularly in the enforcement arena, there are any number of entities that could be regulating a given plan. There isn't just one centralized regulator when it comes to enforcing the Parity Act. So the Department of Labor enforces violations in plans that are employee-sponsored. And that's a large bucket. But then there are also state regulators. There are many different types of plans. There are plans that are through the marketplace. There are small group plans. So there are a lot of different potential enforcement mechanisms, because it's a bit of a patchwork enforcement sort of arena, it's made it hard for any one entity to come down and say, okay, I'm going to take on the violations at X, Y, and Z insurer.
Dr. Harris, I want to talk a little bit about what happens if a family or an individual needs mental health treatment, needs addiction treatment, and that treatment is not covered by their insurance. Can you tell us about maybe an experience that you've seen? What happens then?
Well, the first step is typically, as a physician, I will call or email. Oftentimes it's unclear, someone at the company to advocate for my patient, to see what criteria are needed in order for them to get that treatment. And that, of course, is actually a barrier because often I don't know what the specific criteria are for a particular medication or a particular treatment intervention. But that is the first step. But unfortunately, that first step may take days. It may take weeks. And at the end of the day, patients continue to have the symptoms. They continue to have the disease. And it results in a delay in care. And so one of the things that we recommend at the AMA is that any of my patients who are denied this care, a first starting point, although I agree with the patchwork, is the State Department of Insurance. I know over the last year or so, the AMA has been working with state medical societies and state departments of insurance and insurance commissioners to address this issue. I know that the New York Department of Insurance is very well aware of these issues. So is the AG's office, the Attorney General's office. And so what we need to do is make sure these issues are raised to these departments at the state level. That's a start.
Cynthia, you wanted to weigh in.
A lot of the feedback I actually got was from the provider community about how the crux of the problem for the providers is that the insurers are reimbursing at such a low rate that it's uneconomical to take patients through insured plans. And that seems as though it's a pretty clear-cut issue that regulators or lawmakers could be looking at. And in some cases, providers were telling me they were getting denied. They tried to get into a network and they were told by the insurer that the network was full. And it doesn't seem as though that would make a ton of sense considering the data that we've seen and the access problems that people are reporting all around the country.
And it's sort of, as you're talking, Cynthia, I'm thinking about one of the other things that emerged in your reporting were these ghost networks. So I know a lot of people probably experience this. I know I've experienced it when seeking help of an insurer will say, well, go online, look through the thousands of people that we have there, you know, supposedly for you, and pick somebody. And quite frankly, what you found is that there are lots of folks in those databases who are what?
So I've talked to these people who've gone through 20, 30, sometimes 50 calls trying to find an in-network therapist who takes insurance still, who may not be full. A lot of times they're full. They can't take new patients. There are waiting lists. And so that is what forces a lot of people out of network. And then their copays are very high, and that becomes a barrier to care that a lot of people can't afford. And that the law itself doesn't specifically define network adequacy. So that's an issue that lawmakers could potentially look at, is how do we define network adequacy in a way that people aren't in a position where they're calling 20 providers before they find someone who takes their insurance.
Dr. Harris, how do you respond to that? Because I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that these networks exist, that people are sort of shooting in the dark when they're looking for a provider to begin with. And you mentioned delaying care as one of the obstacles that could make someone's symptoms even worse. So how do you see these sort of ghost networks?
Well, I've lived those ghost networks, both as a patient, as a provider. I've seen my name on a network, and I have not contracted with that particular company. And I've also tried to search and help my patients find therapists. And these networks are totally inadequate, or they're very narrow. So I absolutely agree that that is another area that has to have attention.
And one of the things that prompted us to look into this, and it was your reporting, Cynthia, but also the fact that what's interesting to me is that there aren't a lot of legal actions being taken against these companies. We know that in California, the largest fine against an insurance company was $4 million to Kaiser Permanente in 2013. Why isn't there more of that?
So one of the challenges is the way the law is structured under another law that's basically an employment law essentially doesn't really allow for fines directly from the Department of Labor to the insurer, the end insurer. They might be able to deal with a plan, but the Department of Labor also doesn't disclose the names of the plans that they're necessarily dealing with when they do have enforcement violations. So this is now being taken to plaintiff's attorneys who are finding people who are, from one attorney I spoke to, he was inundated with people coming to him with denials, and he's building class action cases. And there was a very large class action case that went against United Behavioral Health Group earlier this year, specifically dealing with what the judge had said United was prioritizing its bottom line over the needs of its patients. So class action cases like that are probably the way this is going to work through the courts while regulators start to piece together the mechanisms and the actions they want to take.
Doctor, are you encouraged by that path? We have about a minute left in the segment.
I am very encouraged. That ruling really highlighted the pervasive violation to delay in care. And I think one of the things that I've heard from some insurance commissioners is that they don't hear from patients about these violations. So that's why it's very important to notify your state insurance commissioner. But also, the AMA is continuing to work at the state level. Again, these two can be on parallel paths at the state level to work with the regulators to pass state laws to make sure that the insurers are adherent to the parity law. Because I will tell you, we're finding no one has looked at that in 10 years.
Well, now's the time. Dr. Patrice Harris is the president-elect of the American Medical Association, and Cynthia Coons is a healthcare reporter for Bloomberg. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.